This is Fresh Air. Actress Anne Magnusson has said, "As much as I'm influenced by the French playwrights Alfred Jarry and Eugène Ionesco, my roots are more in the Andy Griffith Show." Her roots are also in the downtown Manhattan performance scene that evolved in the late 70s. But she's one of the few, if not the only, actress who has crossed over from there to a TV sitcom. You may know her as the eccentric editor Catherine on Anything But Love, which returns later this year as a mid-season replacement. She also starred opposite John Malkovich in the movie Making Mr. Right. The Museum of Modern Art in New York is hosting a performance series in conjunction with its exhibit High and Low, Modern Art and Popular Culture. Anne Magnusson and her band Bongwater performed there and were recorded by the museum. We'll hear an excerpt of their show, then speak with Anne Magnusson. In this excerpt, Magnusson does a character obsessed with the late Jim Morrison, the leader of the rock group The Doors.
"This is to inform you that Jim Morrison is alive and well and living within me, his cosmic mate Rhea, and four-year-old son Jesse Blue James in Staten Island. His initial rising was in May 1979. Jim has evolved into a state of pure energy and can materialize and dematerialize at will. We are the first human examples of cosmic mate materialization. We are under divine guidance and are part of a divine plan. Jim could drink a whole quart of Jack Daniels, two quarts of Jack Daniels, and still put on an incredible show. Wow, he must have had some kind of stomach, huh? And drugs, he could do an unbelievably amount of drugs and still put on an incredible show. He was a genius. He read books. I met this guy who went to UCLA film school with Jimbo. Wow. What would Jim have thought if you had said back then that he would be the subject of a major motion picture directed by an Oscar-winning Vietnam vet? How ironic, huh? That he would be canonized forever on celluloid, the highest honor society can bestow on an artist. Anyway, so I really did meet this guy who went to UCLA film school with Jim, and he told me the story that they were taking lights from one building to another building, and as they were rolling them along, Jim stopped in his tracks and he stared at this flying squirrel that was impaled on a stake on top of the chain link fence. And he stood there and he cocked his head to one side, you know, with his neck muscles bulging out real sexy. And he looked at that old flying squirrel, the guts hanging out and the flies buzzing around it, and he said, "Well, I guess that just about says it all." Jim Morrison died in a bathtub in Paris, and it was my dream to make a pilgrimage to see his grave. So I got a job as a cocktail waitress at the Sheraton and had to put up with all sorts of humiliations, but I robbed them blind and got the airfare and went to Paris and went right to Père Lachaise and asked the guard, "Where is Jim?" And he said, "Follow the signs." "Signs? What signs?" "Inside, much graffiti. Hypodermic needles shaped as arrows light my fire. Jim this way." We followed them, and an empty beer bottles and cans of wine bottles led us to Jim, the gravesite. A bust had been erected with his long, beautiful, what's that cut that J.C. Bring gave him before he got murdered by the Manson family? What's his name? Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great hair, and somebody had lined his eyes with black and his lips with red, and he looked like Cher. And there were all these Germans tripping around us. And I took an Instamatic snapshot, and I stood and I looked at that grave, and I thought about Jim, and it suddenly dawned on me, what an asshole. I mean, he was an alcoholic, he was a junkie, he was a misogynist, he was fat when he died.
Fat when he died in the pants.
Those leather pants were vinyl. I have this from a very good source.
His hair? What about his hair?
a wig. And his lizard poetry stunk. Plus, I know this hairdresser who does Richard Lewis's hair, kind of that same thing going on. And she used to be an old rock and roll groupie, and she used to hang out the Roxy or the Whiskey or one of those places. And she told me that she was there one time in the 60s, late 60s, and she was with her best girlfriend, who was this beautiful Oriental girl. And they were just in there one afternoon. Nobody else was in there except Jim Morrison was right behind them. And he was drunk on wine.
Yuck.
And for no reason, he turned around and he punched the Oriental girl in the stomach. What a jerk! Yeah, I should have stood in bed.
Anne Magnuson performing at the Museum of Modern Art. Are the groupie characters that you do based on women you've known personally, or is it something more based on your own, like, former fantasies?
Well, I think every young girl who grew up in the 70s had a little bit of a groupie in her. But I don't really see those characters as groupie characters per se. I think they're people like a lot of Americans who are obsessed with celebrities and how to get to know them or how to become one, or somehow feeling that these people lead better lives than they do.
For our listeners who haven't seen your performances, would you describe some of the other characters that you've done over the years in your performances?
Well, let's see. The strange thing is, the characters are becoming less satirical than they used to many years ago. It's hard for me to remember what I did last week, let alone 5 years ago. But I did one performance in the early 80s when Tammy Baker was still only a cable personality and didn't have quite the national exposure that they got later. But I did a show where I portrayed her, and she gets hit on the head in the course of Christian aerobics, gets knocked out, gets caught in between the channels of cable television, and has to go from channel to channel, assuming the identities of each format in search of the Christian Broadcasting Network. And it becomes progressively more surreal until she finds herself in hell and breaks on through to the other side to the an Emmy Awards celebration, where she sings Stairway to Heaven and receives an Emmy Award.
How did you first get to New York?
Well, it was part of, I went to school in Ohio at Denison University, which I didn't care for much at all. I didn't really want to go to school, but I didn't want to go to work either. So I went to school. I went to London for my junior year abroad, and I went back in my senior year and just hated it so much that I figured out a way to spend the last semester of my senior year in New York on a work-study program, and I went there and worked at the Ensemble Studio Theater, which is an off-Broadway theater uptown, and spent all my evenings down at CBGB's going to see the Ramones and Patti Smith, and although they only came in for special appearances, by that point the Dead Boys were kind of the regular house band there, and just start hanging out downtown and getting to know all the different other suburban refugees who were interested in becoming artists and musicians and performers and fashion designers, and got involved in that, the creative explosion that was going on downtown the late 70s and early 80s.
How did you start doing performance art? And before I go any further, I should ask you what you think of the term performance art. I think at this point the term has been as maligned as the term mime. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it has been.
Yeah.
Well, I never really personally ever called myself a performance artist. I was doing things in nightclubs, and a fellow I knew booked me at the Kitchen, I think it was 81 or something, and then I discovered that by calling yourself a performance artist, you could get gigs in other venues besides nightclubs, and people wouldn't throw bottles at you. So I thought, well, what the heck? If it gets me to Japan, I'll be a performance artist. But I also, because I was doing things that were much more entertainment-oriented, because I put a heavy dose of silliness into my shows, the woman who was running the Kitchen at the time, after she saw my program, went directly to the person who was booking their touring program and insisted that I be taken off of it.
Well,
because I got a little bit of flack there at one point because I guess because it was more of cabaret And there was sort of a backlash against that kind of thing, infiltrating the high art of performance, the performance world, which was basically in the let's watch paint dry mode.
When you started performing, it was during the punk rock days, and audiences for punk bands, well, it wasn't uncommon for them to throw things at a band or spit at a band. Did you get any of that kind of reaction yourself when you would perform to some of the same people?
Yeah, except I think the punk thing had dwindled a bit by the time I got to New York. I mean, when I was in London, that's when the Sex Pistols were happening, and that was pretty exciting to be around that when it was first going on. But I remember I had a heavy metal band called Vulcan Death Grip, and we played the Ritz one night, but we were put on the bill. We were opening for Jesus and Mary Chain, which is a band that I think the fans of that band are not the kind that would enjoy a heavy metal parody, which I never saw it as a parody. It was a parody for about the first hour. We got into it. We enjoyed it so much that it just ended up being an excuse to actually be heavy metal musicians. But I got attacked on stage. A woman jumped up and pulled my wig off, and I was left kind of bald on stage. So I jumped in the audience after her, and I had these sausages in my hands, which were props for a song we did called Pig Squeal in Fear, and I jumped in the audience and I found her and I shoved the sausages in her mouth and didn't retrieve the wig, but did retrieve my honor up to a point, and until the roadies started beating everybody up, it got kind of ugly, and that was the last time I performed with Vulcan Death Grip.
You were afraid of the audience reaction after that? Or did you think you had gone too far?
I got a little violent for me. But also, I was tired of doing it. I was ready to move on to the next thing anyway.
Which was what?
Oh, what was it? I don't remember. Feature films. Now I'm ready to do Vulcan Death Grip again. It's a lot safer. It's a lot saner.
Actress and performance artist Ann Magnuson is my guest. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Ann Magnuson is my guest. A lot of our listeners will know you from your role as the editor Catherine in the TV series Anything But Love. That starred Jamie Lee Curtis and Richard Lewis. Describe your character for any of our listeners who hadn't seen it.
Well, you should rent Funny Face in the first 5 minutes. Kay Thompson does a number called Think Pink, and that was that sort of is my guiding light, that image of her going through that number. Well, Peter Noah, the producer, came to me with the idea that the character would be vaguely based on Tina Brown or Anna Wintour, who are the editors of Vanity Fair and Vogue. And I also write magazine articles, and I have had contact with those kinds of people, know a lot of journalists, and got some good stories about crazed editors, and threw all that into the pot. And she's a very eccentric, trend-oriented, information-addled individual who has, instead of a joy of life, I call it a joy of trend. So she's a bit of a satire on the state of the media right now.
Jules, be a dear and get me a cup of tea. I have something very important to share. I've begun therapy. And it has completely changed my outlook. You can expect kinder, gentler editing from this day forward.
Speaking of that, I'd like to talk to you about my column.
Of course, Mike. Didn't you like the changes?
Well, no.
That'll be fine. Let's discuss it in my office.
Hold on. Is there some reason why you just went off in my face?
Oh, yes, I suppose I should explain. Friedrich practices scream therapy. I scream whenever I'm upset. It makes the tension vanish like that.
We're out of English breakfast, so I brought you Earl Grey.
That'll be fine. Come along, Mike.
I've always thought you looked a lot like the young Shirley MacLaine around the Some Came Running era, but I realize now that I'm not alone in thinking that. As a matter of fact,
because
yeah,
I'm the illegitimate love child of Warren Beatty.
Yeah.
But he won't return my phone calls. My mom was she was an exchange student in Italy while he was doing the Roman Spring of Mrs. Stone. And he took her for a wild night in a cheap pensione near the Spanish Steps. I just found this out recently, and I've written a letter to him through the LA Weekly, but he hasn't responded.
Have your Los Angeles experiences and your TV experiences given you more ideas for characters to do in your solo performances?
Well, sort of, but I don't, really in the long run, I don't think a lot of people you run into the Hollywood scene are that interesting. I mean, I think that ground has been plowed so many times. I don't think we need to see anything else about how superficial the Hollywood scene is.
What are some of the stereotypes do you think that people in Los Angeles and in television have of performance artists who got their start downtown New York?
Oh, brother. I think the problem is that people, and it's so easy to make jokes about performance artists because, let's face it, some of them are, you know, pretty ridiculous, myself included. But I think I think people are threatened. You know, I think people in the straight mainstream Hollywood world are threatened by performance art, and the best of which is far more interesting than anything that will ever be on television or in the movies. I mean, people are really trying to, you know, investigate important issues, and those are things that television just can never touch. So I think they're threatened by it, and I also think that then there's a reverse prejudice against people in the East Village who feel that if you have anything to do with mainstream movies that you've sold out in some way. And I think both points of view are very narrow-minded. And I think as long as people continue to dislike those who are different from they are, that we're never going to make any headway.
Well, Ann Magnuson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Actress Ann Magnuson. Here's music from Too Much Sleep, her recent CD with her band Bongwater.
Talent is a vampire, talent is a whore. Talent is American, always wanting more. That which doesn't kill, more grist for the mill. Talent is so sexy, talent is so bright. Talent is always moving forever towards the light. That which doesn't kill.
This is Fresh Air.